Now, we will recall that in the last sermon under this subject of the mighty acts and miracles of God, we saw the creation account. And what we really saw was that the world was recreated after a catastrophe, and in 6 days it was recreated in the present configuration it is now, and that many, many of the things that were created, probably the vast majority of the various flora and fauna that were recreated, were minor reproductions of what had existed in a previous world. Because we have the fossil remains of flora and fauna that was gigantic in size by comparison to the various types of flora and fauna that exist today. So God simply made a minor reproduction of what was in that previous world that was destroyed. With the one exception, of course, being man. Man is unique in that he is made in God's image. So we saw this creation account, and we saw the creation of man. Now we want to go to the next step in the mighty acts and miracles of God, and that was the flood. You see, we find in the Genesis account, I won't rehearse all of this because we are already familiar with it, that Adam and Eve sinned. And in this sin, the end result was that they were cut off from God. They lost the opportunity that could have been given at that time to qualify for salvation. And man was then in a state cut off from God. And he continued in that state. And as he progressed in that state, he grew worse and worse. So that eventually, every fine quality and every principle of righteousness and goodness that God had intended for man to develop was completely shoved to the background and completely removed, so that man, in essence, simply became an intelligent animal. And as the Bible summarizes it here, the earth was filled with violence. Now we can begin here in Genesis, the 6th chapter, because here's where the account begins. It came to pass when men began to multiply on the face of the earth. Now let's keep in mind that men lived prodigious lengths of time, periods of time at that time. I believe the longest living man was Methuselah, who lived 969 years, and he died either in the year of the flood or in the flood. No one knows for certain. But it was quite common to have lengths of years that were approaching 1,000. Now, let's say at least 750. And so when you have this long length of time, and then you have the opportunity to become involved in evil, and you can learn more and more evil, evil is going to proliferate. And we're talking about a time period here which certainly seems to imply a population explosion. Men begin to multiply. You see, we're actually only looking at about the second generation here. We know the Bible tells us that Adam and Eve had sons and daughters. And those sons and daughters at that particular point in the history of mankind contracted marriages, and then to them were sons and daughters born, and men began to multiply. Multiplication means just that. It doesn't mean addition, it means multiplication. So there were vast numbers of human beings on the earth, and daughters were born to them. And the sons of God saw the daughters of men were fair. That word in the Hebrew actually means they saw they were beautiful. They were beautiful, gorgeous women. And so what did they do? They took them wives of all that they chose. So in the context of what is happening here in Genesis, the 6th chapter here, there's something wrong with this. We don't really know because the Bible doesn't tell us, but we can certainly presume that if there were such things as marriages contracted then, there no doubt was rampant divorce and remarriage, and certainly we can assume polygamy was rampant. We should identify, however, who the sons of God are, because there are all kinds of notions that people have about it, but the Bible explains it quite plainly. Notice, first of all, Mark 12, verse number 25. The sons of God were not angels. Many commentators seem to think that this was some kind of a marriage or arrangement between angels and women, which does not happen. Why do we know that? Because, as Jesus said here in Mark 12, verse number 25, here's talking here of angels, or that is, people who are resurrected, when they're resurrected into this new form. For when they shall rise from the dead, they neither marry nor are given in marriage, but are as the angels which are in heaven. So angels do not cohabit with women, and they do not marry. So these sons of God here are defined in Luke chapter 3, verse number 33, and let us notice the statement here. We're reading of the genealogy, verse 38 rather than verse 33. We're reading of the genealogy here, and it takes us all the way back to Adam, and it says here, who was the son of Enos, verse 38, which was the son of Seth, which was the son of Adam, which was the son of God. So men are sons of God by creation. Men are also sons of God by conversion. But in this particular context here, it's clearly talking simply about human beings that were made in God's image, and they're called sons of God, just as Adam was. And these sons of God are these men, what we're reading about here, they took them wives of all they chose. So something was leading to something here. And so the next statement is, the Lord said, my spirit shall not always strive with man. Now we can get an identification as to the meaning of that by turning here to Romans, the first chapter. There are two or three texts here that we can utilize here to show exactly what's taking place when the Bible says, my spirit shall not strive with man. Notice, first of all, Romans 1, verse number 28. There are several texts in this same chapter that relate the same thing. I'm just going to read the one here. And even as they did not like to retain God in their knowledge, so they wanted no part of anything to do with God, they just wanted to do their own human thing. Then we read here, God gave them over to a reprobate mind to do those things that are not becoming. So God just washed his hands of them and let them go. God was not going to strive with them and make them conform. They had a right of free choice, and in that choice they made the wrong decision. Ephesians 4, verse number 30. There are a couple of other texts here we can look at very quickly here, which will illustrate what we're talking about. Here it says, grieve not the Holy Spirit. Meaning, of course, do not injure or damage or counteract the Holy Spirit. And then in 1 Thessalonians 5, verse number 19, one other text here. 1 Thessalonians 5, verse number 19. Quench not the Spirit. So God gives us, as human beings and free moral agents, a right to resist and to reject God's Spirit if we choose to do so. So God was no longer going to work with these human beings, because he said here, as we read back in Genesis 6, verse number 3, for that he also is flesh. That is, he has given himself wholly to the fleshly appetites and fleshly lusts. And when you have a human being who gives himself over to his passions and his lusts and makes no attempt whatsoever to exercise any self-control and decency in what is right, and you have an entire civilization made up of people like that, what would you expect? They have actually found bones and remains of fossil remains of those who were killed in that flood, destroyed in that flood, and they find that their bones were actually cut open, and they were being cannibalized. They were eating the marrow out of their bones. Yes, and so for that reason, God said, yet his days shall be 120 years. So God was going to give man one further period of time of 120 years. And if man did not straighten up in that 120 years, something drastic was going to happen. One of the greatest and mightiest acts of God would occur. Now, the next verse tells us there were giants in the earth in those days. Now, people have wondered how that could be. Well, I hope by the time I'm finished today that you'll have a better understanding of it, but I'll just say briefly here that all species have the ability to develop varieties. And there are species that have developed giant varieties. So the humankind had the capability of developing into a giant variety. And that's what we had here. But when you have these wicked giants, you're talking about a formidable evil that was prevalent in the earth in those days. In fact, they have found partial remains of those giants. I have a book at home entitled Man, Time, and Fossils, I think by Dorothy Moore. I don't remember the author's name, but anyway, she shows photographs in that book that I have of teeth of these giant men, and they're laid side by side with men the size of teeth that we have today, and those teeth were five times larger than our teeth. And they estimate that those men, bodily, were about twice the size of a modern gorilla. And a modern gorilla will grow to 500 pounds. So those men were at least 1,000 pounds. You can imagine the size and prodigious strength they had. Now, after that, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men, which were of old, men of renown. Oh, yes, there were a whole generation or two of these very renowned, powerful men. But they were not righteous men. Because we read in the next verse, God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. In other words, they could not think about anything wholesome, decent, clean, moderate, and good. All that they could think of was evil and violence and filth and trash, and you name it. So you read back in Matthew, the 24th chapter, for example. Matthew, the 24th chapter, and verse number 37. It ought to tell you a lot about what's going on today. Because we read here, as in the days of Noah were, so shall also the coming of the Son of Man be. How much pornography and evil and violence is in the world today? I don't know how much worse it's going to have to be before God finally draws a line, but I mean, it's plenty bad already. Certainly in your bigger cities, it's not so bad in smaller environments, but in some of these large cities, it's just intolerable. So that every imagination, or as it says here, the whole imagination, the entire imagination, everything he could think and devise was only bent on evil. And it was continually. There was never a rebate or a rest. And it repented God, that is, it made God sorry, that's what it means, the Lord, that he had made man on the earth. And it grieved him at his heart. Grieved because of what was going to happen to man. What was going to have to take place. Because of the condition that men had brought this world into, where all semblance of righteousness and decency had been cut off, and men were now on a rampage of violence and evil and sin unparalleled. And Noah, and the Lord said, I will destroy man whom I have created from the face of the earth, both man and beast and the creeping things and fowls of the air, for it repenteth me that I have made them. God says, I'm sorry I even made them. But Noah found grace in the eyes of the Lord. These are the generations of Noah. Noah was a just man and perfect in his generations, and Noah walked with God. Now, there's a double meaning to that. If you check the companion Bible, Professor Bullinger says that that word perfect there means pure in pedigree. That is, the bloodlines have been kept pure. But in addition to that, he was also, as we read here, he was a righteous man and he walked with God. Now, we see a couple of statements made about Noah back here in the New Testament. So let's turn to Hebrews 11 chapter. And notice verse number 7. By faith. We read Noah walked with God, didn't we? And so by faith, being warned of God of things not seen as yet, moved with fear, prepared an ark to the saving of his house, by the which he condemned the world and became heir of the righteousness which is by faith. So Noah was a man of God, and he was a righteous man. In addition to that, 2 Peter 2, verse number 5. Here we read that God spared not the angels that sinned in verse number 4. And in verse number 5, he spared not the old world, but saved Noah, the eighth person, a preacher of righteousness. So he was a servant of God and he proclaimed righteousness. The world didn't heed it, but he nevertheless preached it, bringing in the flood upon the world of the ungodly. So Noah was certainly an unusual man. He was an exception. He was the exception. What was the population at that time? We have no idea. But it must have been numerous. Noah begat three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. And out of those three sons, we have all the races that exist today. The white Caucasian races from Shem. The Negro black races and others similar from Ham. And then Japheth, the father of the Oriental races. The earth also was corrupt before God. The word meaning putrefied or ruined. The world was ruined before God. And the earth was filled with violence. You can just imagine the terror by which people lived in that time. We have people who live in our inner cities today that bolt themselves in and lock themselves in at night because they're afraid, and they're afraid to even go out in the day. It must have been like that everywhere. There was no safe security anywhere. And God looked upon the earth, and behold, it was corrupt. For all flesh had corrupted his way upon the earth. It just virtually ruined it. See, God had made his way known, hadn't he? And so we're coming to a period here of about 1,656 years after creation. And this is the time period we're coming to. We're a little ahead of that just yet because we haven't read about the flood beginning. But this is leading up to it. We're dealing with this 120-year period. And we read, God said to Noah, the end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence through them, and behold, I will destroy them with the earth, or upon the earth, from the earth, as your marginal rendering says. Make thee an ark of gopher wood. No one knows for certain what that wood is, but almost all of the commentators and authorities think it refers to cypress wood, which was a wood that was very efficient for the type of service it was going to be put to. Make thee an ark of gopher wood. Rooms shalt thou make in the ark, cells in other words, and shall pitch it within and without with pitch, or rosin, which is a better translation there. And this is the fashion which thou shalt make of it. The length of the ark shall be 300 cubits, the breadth of it 50 cubits, and the height was 30 cubits. A window shall you make to the ark, in a cubit above thou shalt thou finish it above. And the door of the ark shalt thou set in the side thereof with the lower second and third story shall you make it. Now what it was what I suppose the closest thing we could compare it to today would be a huge barge. It was the shape of a huge barge with three stories, with a roof, and with an open window all the way around so light could filter down through. Three stories. What was the size of it? Nobody knows for certain what cubit they're referring to here, but they do know there are different sized cubits. And if it were the shorter cubit, which is 18 inches long, it would have been 450 feet long, 75 feet wide, and 45 feet high. Now stop and think for a moment. A lot of you are going to be watching football games, although I understand some of you are very saddened because they're showing all the football games today instead of tomorrow. But a football field is 100 yards in length, 300 feet. If this was 450 feet long, it was another half a length of a football field long. Can you imagine that? Just think of it for a moment. Now, if it were the longer cubit, the one that is 21 and some inches long, it would have been 547 feet long, 91 feet high, and 47 feet wide. No, I got that wrong. 547 feet long, 91 feet wide, and 47 feet high. Now, let me read something interesting here. I have two books. One entitled After Its Kind, and the other one, The Deluge Story in Stone, both by Byron C. Nelson. And he gives a description here of the ark. Few who make this objection, that is, that the ark was not large enough, have ever seriously considered the carrying capacity of the ark. And he refers to an article written by Charles Totten, professor of military science and tactics at Yale University, entitled The Flood, The Facts of History. The dimensions of the ark, Totten said, are given in the Bible as 300 cubits long, 50 cubits wide, and 30 cubits high. It had three decks. And regarding the cubit of 18 inches of floor space, on one deck, 450 feet long and 75 feet wide, would have been 33,750 square feet. That's just one floor. He says here, the regulation football field, which has a field of play of 42,000 square feet, is wider but not as long as the ark. But that's just one floor. We're dealing with three floors here. Of the three decks of the ark, there was then a total of 101,250 square feet of deck space. But since it is likely that the small and medium-sized animals were put in cages in tiers one above another, not only the floor space but the cubic space must also be considered. And a measurement of the cubic space for each deck was 500,000 cubic feet, or 1,500,000 for all three decks. Now that gives you a little bit of an idea of in figures. Now let's relate it to something we can understand. 24 inches was what Totten thought the length of the cubit most likely was. Supposing this to be, then, the ark was 600 feet long, 100 feet wide, and 60 feet high, having a carrying capacity of 3,600,000 cubic feet, pointing out that an ordinary cattle car on a railroad carries of cattle 18 to 20 head, or of hogs 60 to 80 head, or of sheep for 8 to 100 head. Totten said, 10,000 such cars, duly proportioned, could be stowed in Noah's Ark. 10,000 railroad cars. Well, that'll give you an idea of the prodigious task that was accomplished by Noah when that ark was built. But he had 120 years to build it, didn't he? So this is the ark here. It had the three floors. And then as we read in verse 17 here, behold, I do bring a flood of waters upon the earth to destroy all flesh wherein is a breath of life. See, what is a human being and what is an animal? The Bible says we are nephesh. We are what is called a nephesh. All that means is a living being who breathes air. That's all it means, no more, no less. Air breathers, that's how we survive. You know, if you've ever done this, I've always thought it was somewhat amusing. You look into a fish tank, And here's these fish in there, and they're swimming around, depending on the size of the tank, and they're swimming around. And you see their mouths open, their gills opening, and they're breathing that oxygen out of that air. And you know, the poor stupid things don't know if all you had to do is just drain out that water, and they'd all be dead, wouldn't they? It's the only thing that sustains them is the fact that they're in that water, and they're absorbing oxygen from that water. Now, you have to oxygenate the water, you know, or you have to change it occasionally in order to have oxygen in it. So most fish tanks will have a little thing down on the backside, and you'll see bubbles coming, and that's what's happening. The water is being oxygenated. Now, that's what our atmosphere is. Our atmosphere is nothing more than a goldfish bowl. If this atmosphere were removed, every living thing on it would perish very quickly. We have the breath of life in us. Now, that breath of life, God says he's going to snuff out. How is he going to snuff it out? By a flood. Because, you see, when a man gets in water, unlike a fish, he doesn't have the capability of sucking the air and running it through his gills and absorbing the oxygen that way. His lungs actually close up on him, and he suffocates very quickly. It's a terrible way to die. Drowning is a terrible way to die. So God says he was going to destroy all flesh wherein is a breath of life from under heaven, and everything that is in the earth shall die. But with thee will I establish my covenant, and thou shalt come into the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with thee, and of every living thing and of all flesh, two of every sort. Now let's skip down here to chapter 7. The Lord said to Noah, come thou and all thy house into the ark. So we're looking at 1,656 years after creation, or 2370 B.C., 2,370 years before Christ. Come thou and all thy house into the ark, for thee have I seen righteous before me in this generation. Of every clean beast thou shalt take to thee by sevens, the male and his female, and of beasts that are not clean by two, the male and his female. So here we have the delineation made at this time period of clean and unclean animals. Some people like to claim, well, that's just a Jewish law and has no relevancy today. Didn't begin until the time of Moses. Not so. God delineated here what beasts were suitable for flesh and which were not. Although there is no evidence that men ate flesh prior to the flood. We do find instruction given after the flood that they could eat animals. But you see, since they had delineated to them the clean and the unclean, then we know there was a difference. They may have eaten meat before the flood, we don't know. But certainly they were given authority and permission to eat it after the flood. Now, we'll read here, let's go over here to verse 17. Verse 15, they went into the ark. And the flood, as we read here, he was commanded to shut the door. This is chapter 7, verse number 17. And the flood was 40 days upon the earth. And the waters increased and bare up the ark, and it was lift up above the earth. And the waters prevailed and were greatly increased upon the earth. And the ark went upon the face of the earth. And the waters prevailed exceedingly upon the earth, and all the high hills that were under the whole heaven were covered 15 cubits upward till the waters prevailed, and the mountains were covered, and all flesh died that moved upon the earth. Verse 22, and all whose nostrils was a breath of life. In fact, it tells us that the fountains of the deep opened up, and this water prevailed. Now, let me read a little bit to you here from two works. I'll read the same one, this one, After Its Kind, by Byron Nelson, the animals that went into the ark. You see, we read here, there were various animals that went in. Of the clean, there were seven pairs, and of the unclean, two pairs. Concerning the animals that live on the land, this author says, and God said, let the earth bring forth living creatures after their kind, cattle and living things and beasts on the earth after their kind, the cattle after their kind, and everything that creepeth upon the ground after its kind. Genesis 1, 24 and 25. In other words, like reproduce like. The Bible is not a textbook of science, and in the first chapter of Genesis, however, because of the matter of the greatest religious importance, the Bible speaks clearly and fairly on a matter of biology. After its kind is a statement of a biological principle that no human observation has ever known to fail. The most ancient human records engraved on stone or painted on the walls of cave bears witness to the fact that horses have ever been horses, bears have ever been bears, geese have ever been geese, reindeer have ever been reindeer, and the most desperate and subtle efforts of man in modern times have been able to alter this divine decree. In other words, you're not going to have something changing into something else. Contrary to evolution. Now, with that in mind, then, we must determine what a species is. Now, if you remember your textbook biology, when you look at the various flora and fauna, we have kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, variety. Varieties, then, are varieties of a particular species. So when we're talking about a species, what are we talking about? Men often speak of a species as any particular type of plant or animal which possesses marked characteristics of its own and breeds true to form. For example, the fox terrier is called a species because it is able to produce offspring like itself. The dachshund, the collie, the police dog are all called species because they're able to produce their own particular forms. In this way, the human race has been divided into several species according to the shape of the head, the color of the skin, and the slant of the eye. But such species are not what the Bible means by the word kind. In other words, kind is broader than a species. Probably what we might call genus today. See, kingdom, phylum, class, order, family, genus, species, variety. Probably genus. In any respect, the author goes on to say here, from the analogy of the human species, in other words, just comparing it, a single pair of dogs likely was created from which have come all the 40 or 50 varieties which can be seen in any large dog show, ranging from the tiny poodle to the Great Dane, with the long shapes and sizes in them. So what the author is really saying is that what they took into the ark was not all these varieties, just one kind. And out of that one kind, after the flood, then came all these various varieties. You take a poodle, for example. The poodle was actually bred in France, believe it or not, as a hunting dog. And there are very large poodles, and they still use them for that purpose. But there's also a miniature poodle and a toy poodle. It just happens to be, by the way, in case you didn't know this, of the dogs that are the worst biters, the number one biter is the Chinese Chow, the number two biter is the German Shepherd, and the number three biter is a poodle. Now, only in comparatively few cases do men know exactly what the limits of a natural species are. That there is a limit is the evident teaching of the first chapter of Genesis, but just what forms of life are comprised in certain natural species is not definitely known. It is known pretty accurately that the limits of the horse, what the limits of a horse species are, that it does not include the ass, since the cross between the horse and the ass is a sterile animal. It's a hybrid, unable to reproduce. The limits of the natural species dog are more definitely known. It includes not only the large variety of domestic dogs that we know as dogs, but the jackal, the wolf, and the coyote as well. It does not include the fox, which is another natural species. All forms of dogs are capable of crossbreeding and producing fertile offspring. So then he gives a summary statement over here. Truth derived from observation of nature demands that power variation be it admitted in species. Truth derived from the scripture demands that this power of variation is limited. Both demands are satisfied by the scientific definition of a species adopted and defended by Professor William Bateson, president of the British Association for the Advancement of Science. A species is a group of organisms with marked characteristics in common and freely interbreeding. So what he's really saying is that they did not take every kind of variety that we have today into the ark. They just took the kinds And it would certainly have limited the number of animals that would be in the ark. And then in addition to that, since the time of the flood, those animals, all these various varieties have developed. You take, for example, a bloodhound. You talk about a unique animal. They say that the smell of a bloodhound is between 1 million to 10 million times more powerful than the smell of a man. And a good bloodhound for hunting purposes is worth now about $5,000 apiece. Because he has to be able to pick up a cold track. In other words, one that's even several days old. He can pick up that track, and he will stay on that track faithfully until that animal is treed, and then he will not leave that tree. He'll bay and he'll howl until his master comes, and that dog is worth many dollars. There are other dogs that don't have that kind of smell at all. So there are all kinds of animals that have been developed, many of them by man. But what was put in the ark was limited. Now, we see here, notice verse 21 of the 7th chapter. All flesh died that moved upon the earth, both of fowl and of cattle and of beast and of creeping thing that creepeth upon the earth, and every man. All in whose nostrils was a breath of life, and all that was in the dry land died. So they were destroyed by the flood. Now the next question we should ask, what evidence is there that a flood occurred? Well, for one thing, you can go to almost any place in the earth and find evidence that what is now the landmass at one time was underneath the surface. You'll find seashells at the highest elevations, particularly in limestone deposits. But I have another series of interesting facts to give you now here. This is from the book, The Deluge Story in Stone by Byron Nelson, the same one that I just quoted. And if you're familiar with the theory of evolution and geology as it is applied, organic geology as it is applied to the theory of evolution, you will be told that these various layers of strata that are on the earth today came about as a result of many millions of years of settling in the particular locations they're in. Notice what the author says. Twemlow's efforts, this is a geologist, a major general in the British Army who studied geological conditions in many lands, and he wrote a book, Facts and Fossils Adduced to Prove the Deluge Story of Noah and to Modify the Transmutation System of Darwin. So his whole book was an attempt to repudiate Darwin. Twemlow said, after heavy rains, have you ever observed streams carry materials, say chalk and sand, down a slope, depositing each in distinct ridges, the heaviest first and the highest in accordance with specific gravity, and the lightest last and lowest, and then reflected during the 150 days in which the diluvial waves passed over the earth and the subsequent months of deposit, what vast ridges of distinct materials may have been deposited, what deep valleys filled up. If so, you will be led to understand that the Almighty would not require 300 million years specified by Darwin for the accumulation of the stores of minerals deposited. So what he's saying is that when you look at all the strata today on the earth, it did not come about as a result of millions of years of deposits. It came about as a result of the flood and the activity that occurred after the flood as the waters were receding. Now, here was another author. He claims that In the flood, the land was covered to a depth estimated to at least 16,000 feet. Well, I don't know how high the mountain ranges were then, because there no doubt have been vast changes that have occurred even since that time. We have, Mount Everest, it's 29,000 feet. Well, I think you can say one thing about Mount Everest. If they knew it was there and they thought they were going to get up it, they would have found themselves in bad luck. Even if it went to 16,000, but the Bible says everything was covered, so we don't know what the strata was at that time or the height of the mountains, but everything was covered. Now, he's giving an example here now of what happened now underneath this level of water. At the bottom of such a mass of water, there would be a pressure of over 50 tons to the square foot where the water stood still. Now you can see how fossils are formed, can't you? When it flowed fast and pressed against elevations, the pressure might be increased 2 or 3 times that much. So let's say 100 to 150 tons per square foot. Such a mass of water moving violently over the surface would play utter havoc with the earth, and solid sandstone hills would be pulverized by the awful force and weight. Resistant masses of other kinds of rocks, like ancient coral reefs, which had been built up over the centuries, would be shattered into small fragments, and these fragments spread out in layers would form the so-called limestone breccias and similar strata, which, as he says, is so difficult for uniformitarian geologists to explain. That is, the ones that are trying to claim it was done over 300 millions of years. And Bozio supposed that without the possibility of being corrected, while the land was free of water where Noah debarked, so that in Noah's view the earth was dry, elsewhere for centuries the waters may have been still in the process of going and returning from off the earth. This is quite true. It took many, many years for the floodwaters to finally recede. In fact, at one time, the early explorers up into northwestern Europe thought Scandinavia was just a series of islands. And when the water finally receded, we have Norway, Sweden, and Finland. In fact, it's well known that when the Vikings would make a raid, they would start out from their bases in Scandinavia. They would row across the Baltic, up the river, the Vistula, and some of those other rivers that come down from Russia into the Baltic Sea, and they'd hit the pre-pit marshes, and they would row all the way across the pre-pit marshes to the Black Sea, and then float right down into the Black Sea, and then began to raid along the Black Sea and the whole coast of the Mediterranean with as many as 1,500 ships in a raid. They did that for 1,000 years, till those pre-pit marshes finally all evaporated and went down. No longer did they have the accessibility to the Black Sea. And then he mentions the traditions of the floods in various other places in the earth. Now, you're going to find this to be most interesting. Here's a book entitled The Mammoth in the Flood by a man by the name of Howarth, published in 1887. And Howarth's argument for the deluge was based principally on the manner in which elephant remains are found in Siberia. Now, you can't see this too well because this is a globe looking straight down on top. But here is Siberia. See, it goes almost a whole length across Russia, where all this darker area is. It's thousands of miles. Literally millions of elephants have been found there. Now, why do we know they were not prior to the flood? Why do we know they were not killed in the first catastrophe before we read about the creation count in the book of flood? A creation account in the book of Genesis. Because these mastodons have been found intact and their flesh is still edible. Because they're found in big glaciers and big snow pits, and they're still edible today. They would not be in that shape had they been destroyed in the first catastrophe. I'm saying they're edible for people that eat them. That's not us. So, as Howarth undertook, he proved that in the first place a very great cataclysm or catastrophe occurred, by which that animal with its companions were overwhelmed over a very large part of the earth's surface. And secondly, that this catastrophe involved a widespread flood of waters that not only killed the animals, but also buried them under continuous beds of loam or gravel. And thirdly, in the same catastrophe, which accompanied by a very great and sudden change of climate in Siberia, by which the animals, which had previously lived a fairly temperate conditions, were frozen in their flesh under the ground and remained frozen ever since. It's estimated that the temperature drop was 450 degrees in about a 4 or 5 hour period, which seems to imply that if you had that kind of a environment where vast numbers of mastodons were located up northern, what we would call the Arctic, and eating vast amounts of greenery, then the climate must have been even over the whole face of the earth at that time. And what caused the climate change was the shift of 23.5 degrees in the tilt of the earth, which causes the seasons. And with that tilt, this vast sudden freeze set in and still remains to this day. Now, he's talking here about mammals. Here's a footnote, it's rather interesting. Evolutionary geologists called a mammoth an extinct species, but with little reason. Mammoths were little larger than the modern Indian elephant and were otherwise identical in structure. They had a thicker covering of hair that do most modern than do most modern elephants, but since, as we know, there was a very great variation within other species with two amounts of hair. For example, Mexico has a hairless variety of the dog. It is most reasonable to suppose that the mammoth was but a variety of the modern elephant. That's all it was. It wasn't that much larger. So they were existing at the time man was here. So these cave stories of men trying to kill mammoths with spears was quite likely true. It was within the time period of man, probably in the pre-flood world. There is perhaps no inquiry, says Holworth, in the whole range of natural history more fascinating or romantic than that which deals with the mammoth. Even children and unsophisticated people have their imagination stirred when they read how in the dreary and inhospitable wastes of northern Siberia, where neither tree nor shrub will grow, where the land for hundreds of miles is covered with damp moss barely sprinkled for 2 months with a few gay flowers, and during the rest of the year is locked into ice and snow, and where only the hardiest polar animals can live, that there are found below the ground huge hordes of bones of elephants and other great beasts whose appetites needed corresponding supplies of food. But our interest rises to the highest pitch when we are told that this vast cemetery not only teems with flesh bones and beautiful ivory tusks, but that the carcasses and mummies of the great animals, so well preserved in the perpetually frozen soil, that the bears and wolves can feed upon them. You don't hear much about this these days, but I can remember reading many reports years ago about the finds of these mammoths, these mastodons. For example, the explorer Wrangell, remember Wrangell Island? It was named in honor of him. Was Hormel's authority for saying, the soil of Bear Island, this is one of those islands up in Siberia there, consists only of sand and ice with such quantity of mammoth bones that they seem to be to form the chief substance of the island. The whole island is made out of bones. The natives who live in the region of the Lena River, this is one of the rivers that flows into the Arctic Circle at the north there. I suppose it's frozen the year round now, but that river is still extant. It is a vast stream which twists and turns to make a course of over 2,000 miles. The natives who live in the region of the Lena River make a living traveling up and down the river in boats, gathering up the ivory tusks they see sticking out of the cliffs on the side of the river or which they find fallen to the edge of the water. And this occupation is followed by those who live on other streams. They sell the ivory tusks from these mammoths. Been going on for years. Between these rivers, there are places which have been discovered having so many elephant remains that Holmes said the ground might be said to consist entirely of mammoth bones. Now, if you had such vast herds of elephants up there, then you had a climate that could accommodate them. But that doesn't exist today. All this vast peninsula, the Chukchi Peninsula, says Holworth, is rich in fossil bones, and so plentiful are the remains of the animals that the natives use bones, which contains fatty matter, for fuel. Actually burn them. And elephants and rhinoceros has formed the bulk of the fossils in this region. And there is not in all of Russia, from the Don as far as the extremity of the peninsula of the Chukchis, a river or stream, especially those flowing into the plains, on the banks of which or in the beds of which there have not been found bones of elephants or other animals foreign to the climate. That is what we'd call foreign today. Wasn't foreign at that time. And the modern rivers of Siberia have nothing whatsoever to do with the astounding burial conditions there. In other words, it didn't occur over a long period of time, and it wasn't a matter of the water rushing, flowing over them and burying them in those deposits. It's like the La Brea tar pits in the Los Angeles region. You read anything about fossils, you've all seen the story how these animals waded out into this big tar pit. Remember that? The little elephant or the little dinosaur went out in the tar pit and he got stuck, and his mother rushed out to save him, and she got stuck, and then the father rushed out to save him, and they got stuck, and they all went down in the tar pit and drowned. You've all seen that, haven't you? Well, I can tell you what it is. It's a cock and bull story. What that La Brea tar pit is, it was a place where all of these fossil bones were forced by some flow, and they're just thousands of them in there, and they were just forced into that configuration and remained there for many years, and then the oil began to seep up through from underneath, and the oil seeped up to the surface of the land, and they're all encased in this oil, and it was not a matter of falling into a tar pit. They have even found, as it says here, here was a report in the New York World, June 1, 1930, Fairbanks, Alaska. Well-preserved skeletons of lions, elephants, mastodons, horse, bear, bison, moose, and various rodents have been uncovered here by the two huge gold dredging machines cutting into the fossil-filled muck which overlays the gold-bearing gravel. For more than 100 years, engineers, prospectors, and miners in Alaska have encountered tusks, bones, and skulls of extinct Pleistocene animals exposed in the banks of rivers, and the gold mining dredges now being pushed deep into the old earth have years of work ahead, and already the scientific results greatly surpass expectation. To date, the collection recovered includes the largest number of different animals ever found in one field. That's in Alaska. And in the southern part of Siberia, far inland from the sea, Hoover says only the bones of the destroyed creatures are found, but in the northern part, where the ground is frozen all the year round, not only the bones are discovered, but the flesh also, often in a state of preservation that the red meat remains suitable for dogs and wolves. Whole carcasses have been found with eyes which still retain their glassy stare. When the stomachs have been examined, the kind of vegetation which they have eaten before they died can be made out. Now, those animals had to perish in the flood. That's the only way they could be in the condition they're in. I have a lot more to read, but as he says here, this condition existed generally throughout the world. It wasn't just limited to Siberia. And in Italy, for example, immense numbers of elephants are entombed in a stratum beneath another entirely different fossil content. And these show no signs of having been disturbed. And they thought, well, these must have been the elephants that Hannibal brought over during the Punic War. Nonsense. And in southern Europe and in northern Africa, different sorts of animal fossils are met with. Hippopotami bones become abundant. They're found in Greece, Algeria, and in the islands of the Mediterranean. And the fact of the bones occurring in great catches or deposits in which various species are mixed pell-mell, like the La Brea tar pits, is very important. If animals die occasionally from natural causes, different species do not come together to do so, nor does the lion come to take his last sleep with a lamb. The fact of finding masses of animals remains of mixed species, all showing the same state of preservation, not only points to a more or less contemporary death, but is quite fatal to the theory that they ended their days peaceably or by natural causes. If they had been exposed to the air and to the severe transitions between midwinter and midsummer, which characterize Arctic latitudes, they would have decayed rapidly. But their state of preservation proves they were covered over and protected ever since, and this along many degrees of longitude and by continuous undisturbed beds of clay and gravel. So I guess I won't try to read all of this. I have more here, but at least it gives you an idea. He points out the examples found in Siberia and Europe, and they're not a result of a gradual accumulation. And he gives further proof here as to why it could not have been something other than a catastrophe. But that pretty well, I think, summarizes the material that's available to prove there was a flood. So what do we read here? Genesis 7, verse 17, the flood was 40 days upon the earth. The flood was. And then it continued. And then we read here, notice verse 24, and the waters prevailed upon the earth 150 days. Then they began to recede, and they receded to a large extent, probably rapidly at first, and then there was a slow process of receding that went on for hundreds of years. So that at one period of time, you know why Europe was so late really being settled in large colonies? Because for the most part of its history, it was an uninhabited, wet and damp, swampy forest. It took many years for Europe to dry out, just as it did Scandinavia. So the second great act, mighty act of God, was the destruction of wicked man and as a result of his evil and his violence, and then the saving of Noah and his family by means of the ark. Now God did make a promise to Noah here in the ninth chapter. He said in verse 13, I have set my bow in the cloud, and it shall be for a token of a covenant between me and the earth. And it shall come to pass, that's Genesis 9, verse 14, when I bring a cloud over the earth, that the bow shall be seen in the cloud, and I will remember my covenant, which is between me and you and every living creature of all flesh, and the waters shall no more become a flood to destroy all flesh. The final destruction, the Bible says, will be fire, but it'll never again be by a flood. One of the great and mighty acts of God in restoring sanity and righteousness to this earth.